episode is sponsored by Cytiva. Cytiva, now with the life sciences business from Paul, is a global provider of the technologies, services, and expertise that researchers and biopharma companies need to bring transformative medicines from discovery to delivery. Learn more at cytiva.com. That's CYTIVA.com.
You're listening to The Top Line, brought to you by Fierce Pharma and Fierce Biotech. I'm your host, Ayla Ellison. Like many of you, I kicked off the new year by heading to San Francisco for the annual JP Morgan Healthcare Conference. On my flight back home to Chicago, I read a report about closing the women's health gap. While it's a known fact that women, on average, live longer than men, the report unveiled a nuanced reality. Women also spend more of their lives grappling with poor health. After reading the report, I knew I had to talk to the co-authors to dive into the issue further. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Kelly Moley and Dr. Valentina Sartori. Dr. Moley is an obstetrician-gynecologist by training who has worked in women's health for over 30 years. Since last year, she has been the Global VP of Clinical and Translational R&D, Reproductive Medicine, and Maternal Health at Ferring. Dr. Sartori is a leader of the life sciences practice in Europe at McKinsey. She has a PhD in modeling and simulation for optimal drug administration and leads R&D strategy with pharmaceutical clients. In today's episode, they discuss the root causes behind the women's health gap and the staggering economic impact. They also shed light on viable pathways to close the women's health gap and create a future where women not only live longer, but lead healthier lives. Let's dive into the discussion now.
Dr. Moley and Dr. Sartori, thank you so much for joining us today for this episode of The Top Line. I'm thrilled today to be talking to you about an extremely important report that just came out, diving into the women's health gap and issues surrounding women's health globally. My first question today has to do with some of the findings from the report, which it highlighted, as most of us know, that women on average live longer than men. However, the report really dug into this and emphasized that this is not really a full picture, as women spend a greater percentage of their lives in poor health. Can you talk a little bit about that finding and explain why it was deemed crucial to include it in the report? Dr. Moley, if you could weigh in on that one.
Yes, I'd love to. Thank you for that interesting question. The definition of poor health is different than life expectancy. Disabilities, as they classify them in this report in women, are all gynecologic. The majority are gynecologic. And they're not deadly per se, things like endometriosis or menopause or polycystic ovary syndrome, but they're chronic diseases that are unique to women and affect them at a high prevalence. And currently there are no therapies. And chronic illnesses in men, such as coronary artery disease, stroke, hypertension, diabetes, cancers, their drugs were all designed for men in mind. And so if you look actually at the statistics, the age of men dying is maybe going down, but the age of women and the occurrence of women with these illnesses is going up. So what I'm trying to say is that the medications that were designed for chronic illnesses in men are effective, whereas because of the lack of women's research and the lack of clinical trials in women, we just don't understand the diseases, and therefore the drugs that were created were not for them in mind. The disabilities in women are significant, and it very well highlighted in this report that was really the first to take a critical view of this.
And you touched on something that was highlighted in the report, which was the lack of funding and research around some of these women's health issues. The report highlighted several root causes of what is the women's health gap. Can you talk a little bit more about those causes and what they are, Dr. Moley?
Yes, I'd love to. And just as background, I am an obstetrician gynecologist, and I've lived this life as far as taking care of women and realizing that the bias in the healthcare towards women. Women's health has been excluded from clinical medicine for quite a while. And really, women were just thought to be small men in their size, and therefore it was thought that they responded the same to drugs, maybe at a slightly lower dose, and that their diseases and the diagnoses and the treatments were the same. But what we've learned is that's not the case. And I think this is beautifully exemplified in a study from 1973 that was published in JAMA, a Journal of the American Medical Association. And in this article, there were 9,000 people in a clinical trial looking at the secondary effects of estrogen postmenopausally given, and looked at their cardiovascular events, strokes. And in this study, all 9,000 participants were men. There was not a single woman that was placed on estrogen. And so the results of the study, which looked at blood pressure and stroke and all these things, were all recorded in men. And it just blows my mind that those studies are just typical of many studies of drugs for women, even for women's diseases. And now we know that cardiovascular disease appears differently and is treated differently. And we now know that women respond differently. But that's just one example. And so I think we have to understand that there's very little data. Women were not included in clinical trials until 1993. And even after then, representation and disaggregation by sex in the reporting of the outcomes of these studies was never done. And so the vast amount of data that we have is all about men. And so men are the default in the science, in medicine, and in the treatments. And even the research in animals was all done in male animals. And this changed as of 2014. It's quite shocking that as of probably early 2000s, over 50% of the drugs in the market had never been tested in women. So the science and the investment is the number two thing that's cited in this report. And what it clearly delineates is the deprioritization of research into women's health. And this I experienced firsthand. I was a physician scientist at Washington University trying to get research grants. And even though I was continuously funded, it was very, very difficult to get funding around women's health, and especially maternal women in pregnancy. And as a result, the field in reproductive medicine has really fallen far behind that of, say, cancer or diabetes. And so less science means less incentive for pharma and other stakeholders to engage in driving innovation in this area. So this leads to a vicious cycle of a lack of science, a lack of endorsement, and a lack of investment.
Like you said, women's health can be an extremely difficult area to get funding in for research, for further development of drugs. One of the interesting things in this report, too, that was highlighted was it wasn't just a call to action for more funding or research specifically for conditions that affect women, but looking at drugs for conditions that affect both men and women and figuring out how those treatments might work differently in women than men. The report notes that closing the women's health gap is about health equity. It's about inclusivity, and it really dives into the economic impact as well. According to the report, addressing the women's health gap and investing in women's health could add about $1 trillion to the economy annually by 2040. And Dr. Sartori, can you talk a little bit about that? How was that figure calculated and what factors contributed to that substantial amount?
Let me say it's minimum $1 trillion, right? And let me tell you why. Number one, as Kelly and you were alluding, what is women's health is, of course, what is uniquely for women. So whatever has to do, for example, with having, let's say, ovaries, let me call it, right? So endometriosis, menopause, ovarian cancer. But then it's also what is different in women, and Kelly already alluded to cardiovascular diseases. But also the third component is disproportionate in women. So let me take autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis or lupus. They impact women much more than men, or even Alzheimer's. So all of this for us is women's health, and now, let's say, what creates this, how can I say, impaired living, right? Or lower quality of life during life. So we took this definition and then we said, what is the gap compared to men? And of course, in conditions that are only for females, you don't have a gap because, of course, men don't experience them. But if you look at the other diseases, you can say men have better outcomes or that their burden of disease is different. And we see that actually 45% of the overall women's health burden is in those diseases that are affecting them disproportionately or differently. Huh? And 5% are the female-specific conditions. For the remaining, let's say, almost 50%, we don't know because there is not enough data to disaggregate what's the difference in men and women. And now you take this and you say, look, is this gap and this lower quality of life at the end of the life of women? Actually, it's not. It's between the age of 20 and 60, you have 50% of this burden and this gap. So if you take all of what I said, you're like, oh, wow, women are living these health issues during the years where they are supposed, let's say, to study or to work or to contribute to society, to be active in their communities, to take care of their families. But they cannot express their full potential because they have these conditions that are not either fully well diagnosed or well treated because of what Kelly referred to. And then we say, okay, but now can we close the gap compared to men? And by doing, for example, more tailored drug development or interventions from an healthcare perspective that take into account the differences between men and women. And if we do that, we can reduce the burden. And so women are able to live a better life. They can live longer. They are less affected by diseases. They can be more productive and participate more. So if you take all of this together and you say, look, there is an average GDP contribution per individual, and you say, out of all these interventions that allow women to improve the quality of life of women, we have 137 million women more active in the workforce and in the workplace by 2040, then we get to this 1 trillion. Now, why did I say it's also at least 1 trillion? Because in all the things I said, the data is the data we have today. But we know that there is significant underreporting in many of these conditions because some of these conditions are discarded. Some, in some cases, the symptoms are different and even doctors are not fully aware, or women, right? Nobody's fully aware of the differences on how heart attack manifests itself in women or men. And so they get worse outcomes. So if we now don't realize that and we develop a more women-centric approach, right, to everything, you should be able, let's say, to scale those interventions and deliver these better outcomes that will lead to higher productivity or participation.
The $1 trillion amount in the report, I thought was quite significant when I first read it, but hearing more details about how this was calculated and the amount, it's likely that it would be far more than that if we had a full picture with more data to examine. Is that right?
You got it entirely right. And, you know, I was alluding earlier that we have some data. We don't have always this aggregation of data on the differential outcome for men and women. And also we have a 50% burden of disease where we don't know if there is a difference between men and women. And so indeed, as we learn more, these numbers might change, right? We might have a better understanding of how much female-only or different in women or disproportionate in women really affect women more completely. The example I wanted to give is also menopause. We have seen data, for example, from different sources that basically give a factor of 10 difference in prevalence of menopause. We've seen data that said for 100 women menstruating, we have only 30 going through menopause. So, you know, every woman will go through menopause. Maybe not everyone will experience symptoms, but it cannot be that from 100 you go to 30 unless they've all died in between, which I don't think is the case. And we have taken this into account and we have corrected, let's say, for this potential bias in the data. But still, if you take menopause as an example of implication on GDP, you have something like you have women between the age of 45 and 60 that experience symptoms, which are actually more than 40. It's not sleeping, it's hot flashes, it's depression. And this will impact their willingness to stay in the workforce, their willingness to contribute, their ability to contribute at their best self. Now, if we develop better solutions, which are not just pharmaceuticals, but also supporting the workplace, supporting the family, right? Interventions of also with healthcare providers, we can help these women cope with the symptoms and live their best possible lives. And if we do that, they can, you know, addressing menopause in the workplace, let's say, can unlock something like $120 billion And again, as I was saying, it might be an underestimation for now because we might know more, right, in the future about this condition and many others that affect women.
This report does provide more clarity around the problems. So my question, and I'll start with you, Dr. Molly, for this one, what is the path forward from here? How can we move forward and make progress in closing this gap that's been identified in the report?
Thanks for letting me answer that. Faron Pharmaceutical has been one company that is really focused on supporting women's health through treatment innovation and advocacy for more than half a century. We focus a third of our R&D budget in this area, and we're committed to addressing unmet needs all the way from conception to birth. And this includes the major reproductive years as well. And this is enabling millions of people to access care and treatment and support they need to build a family. And that's through our Project Family Initiative. Our Project Family Initiative is really to listen to patient experiences and the requirement to generate the right outcome. And through that, then we design our strategies and our R&D, research and development, to address and answer these concerns. We have a phase 3 R&D program in women's health, and it's currently focused on addressing unmet needs in postpartum hemorrhage, as well as infertility. Postpartum hemorrhage is quite a global problem. Approximately 70,000 women die every year from postpartum hemorrhage. Historically, there's been a lack of treatments that are effective without being stored in a cold chain fashion. So we developed a heat-stable, long-acting solution to this, and that's part of our Safe Birth. We provide these formulations to prevent postpartum hemorrhage. It's unbelievable to think that in the last 30 years, there have been only 2 new drugs for this very severe maternal condition. But it's not only pharmaceutical companies that can play a role in taking this landmark report, but this is also, it needs to be introduced and rolled out to other stakeholders beyond just pharmaceutical companies and investigators. And that's why here at Davos, we are introducing the Global Women's Health Alliance, a brand new group of members, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as representatives from the Biden White House Initiative for Women's Health Research, as well as other private sector groups. And this is a good start. It's a beginning for us to involve stakeholders. The regulatory environment has also been a deterrent to development and innovation in this space. We understand that women are different, especially women with a child who are pregnant. And this brings up many ethical and concerns about regulatory issues. However, working with regulatory environments to help test and make sure these are safe in women, but also to perhaps create some compromises for development of drugs in this space. So personally, I think regulators are key stakeholders to also have in this group, as well as policymakers. And that's what I hope and I think is the initiative behind this Global Alliance in Women's Health that's being introduced at this meeting.
There is almost a role for each and single of us to play, because if we think about the gap in awareness, right, we need to keep discussing this, reframing the conversation, breaking the taboos at times that are, yes, for example, particularly in female-only conditions, people don't talk about it enough. In the ones that are disproportionate or different in women, how do we raise the awareness of this difference? And it's with each single one of us, but also with the medical community, with academia, how do we change and introduce a more women-centric lens so that we are all understanding the differences? And we need more financing then to understand the science, right? What does it mean that it's different, and what are then the best solutions forward? To me, the good news is that we see some progress. We have seen, while doing this research, we saw, for example, hospitals in the US that understood those differences and, for example, developed protocols to release women after, for example, PCI that followed a different checklist for men and women. So there are already initiatives that we can be very proud of, and we can scale them to close this gap. There are some cases where we're seeing also in pharmaceutical companies understanding the difference, how the differential effect of a drug in men and women, but is not the norm. And we need to push to have more data, more information, more disaggregation, more analysis, and understanding the implications.
Thank you both for joining today. It will be interesting to see moving forward, continuing to look at these issues, the work of the Alliance and this cross-sector collaboration, and making more progress in closing this women's health gap.
That's it for The Top Line. I'm your host, Ayla Ellison. You can find out more about this topic in our show notes at fiercepharma.com. Look for podcast. And that's The Bottom Line from The Top Line.